One of the weird things about technology in 2023 and is the fact that we have no knowledge of whether what we're actually reading is real, because you have that new technology of artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, and there's 10 other ones that are coming out every day. And so you don't know if what you're reading about something is real.
For sure. No, in fact, everything that I see written in magazines and stuff, I question what, how much of it's really written by AI, and it, you know, is there a person behind this? You know, you ask questions, you look at stuff, and you don't know where it came from. It could be written, you know, by some machine.
And what's weird too is that it's all digital. You don't actually get to touch it. I mean, you're sliding your hand on a piece of glass to look at digital information. But the good thing about today is that you have still a paper trail of typewriter history, as an example, through ephemera.
Absolutely, yeah. And Peter Wheel, who we are lucky to have in Texas with us, is has one of the largest collections of typewriter ephemera around. And the thing about that is it wasn't written by artificial intelligence. It was written by somebody that was thinking about, you know, turning it, you know, into print. It's a piece of paper that you can, it's tactile. It's got a date on it from, you know, 1903.
Right.
You know, it's locked down, whereas... And give it 50 years and you see something and you're going to ask, what's that generated for? You won't even know what it was generated for.
And that stuff goes back 100, 125 years, and it's still around today in paper form.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's the ephemera that he collects. When he has conversations with us, he's backing it up with part of his collection. So
right.
It's beautiful.
Well, folks, kick back, get your popcorn ready, and let's dive into a recording with Peter Wheel and Evadito and myself right here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Welcome to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to listen to our little gab fest. We're just a group of folks who enjoy the heck out of typewriters and welcome you to our table. Sit back and enjoy the show. And away we go. All right, Austin Typewriter Inc., we are in the house once more in Houston, Texas, and I'm being joined today by Evadito, and we have a wonderful guest. Evadito, how are you today?
I'm doing marvelous. It's a beautiful day, sunny, temperature's perfect.
You know, we had so much fun last time we were in Houston. Not only did we have a type-in, but before that type-in, we had a conversation that hopefully many of you have already heard. But we were at the home of Peter Wheel, and he was so kind to invite us back to come and talk more about typewriters and all kinds of different things that he's got in his head that we're going to be sharing today. So, Everett, you want to just take right off and introduce Peter, and
yeah,
let's
absolutely.
Go.
Peter is amazing. Peter has a wonderful background. I do not know everything about Peter. I haven't read his curriculum vita or anything for prepare for this. But Peter, the main thing that I have run into and love reading are some of the Etc. magazines that Peter contributes to. In fact, I just got this one in for the fall of 2021, and Peter pulled together this wonderful article about inside the duplex failure, the duplex machine. And I read this in the previous interview, and we were talking about the bits and pieces that he was talking about, like the metallurgy and the importance of ephemera, really spoke to me on this, and it just led right into it. So,
but Peter, welcome to our welcome to our podcast once again.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here with you all.
No, but speaking of Etc., we were just looking at the pages before we got here to your home, and I said, well, we've got to start off with Etc. because that's such a huge history and has such amazing content. So,
I know Peter has contributed quite a bit to the Etc. magazines, and the thing that I've noticed is Peter is amazing at pairing images and text. And when you put image and text next to each other, there's some sort of little magic that happens that you're amazing at doing. And do you want to speak to the duplex? And
well, first, I guess the most important thing I think is that people who are interested in typewriters start out interested in an object, so a real thing.
Right.
The problem, if you mainly just talk about typewriters, is that you don't have the thing. And that's the fundamental thing. The second thing is, I think that many of us, even who are heavy users of typewriters, who write on them and such, that the form of the typewriter does matter to us. People care about colors. They care about the way that, the keyboard is set up, not only in terms of the obvious things like QWERTY or QWERTY or whatever, but the form of the keys. People talk about, I don't like this because I don't like glass top keys. I love glass top keys, that kind of thing. So you need images, and you need compelling images. They need to be interesting enough that someone wants to look at them to start with. So I'm never offended when somebody says, I hadn't had a chance to read it yet, but I really enjoyed the pictures. But that's it's a way of getting into a conversation about an object. I think that et cetera, at least from my perspective, and ever since I know when Richard took it over in 2006, is significantly driven by the images. My collecting for purposes of creating my ephemera archive was driven partly by a desire to have those images, sometime with a plan. For example, I had a plan about, I wanted to ultimately do a story about typewriter factory baseball teams. Mm-hmm. And the pictures were very hard to find. We're talking about something that starts in the late 1880s. You don't start getting frequent pictures of baseball players in the field until after about 1910 or so. Hmm. So the problem was to find any kind of images, even the team pictures where they're in a studio being very formal, much less actually playing. So beginning around 2002 or so, I began to collect these pictures, and they were not common. I found one picture once at a toy antique show.
Wow.
That was a player for the Oliver team. The point is that sometime I do collect to put things together for a story I ultimately want to do. I didn't do that story until, 2017 or so, mm-hmm. 2018. And then that got republished in a scholarly journal on the history of baseball. And most of those scholars never knew, one, about that much about industrial baseball, but two, about typewriter baseball. And the typewriter baseball was important because of the way typewriter companies organized themselves. They were organized often in small towns like Ilion, right? And you lived in the company town, right? There was a kind of hierarchy, a very strong hierarchy in the factory. And what marked factories was is that you had assembly lines in which you had a regular order of everything to be done. People entered the employment often in low-level jobs, like literally hand-winding springs. And they have a little spring winder that looks like a pencil sharpener,
mm-hmm.
Or something like that, a manual pencil sharpener. And so most of your life, usually originally around 65 hours a week, you were in this production line. And then when the companies created the baseball teams and supported them, the baseball had to practice, but also there's a randomness about baseball. So you have this contrast between the highly ordered life of working in the factory and the randomness of the wonderful thing about playing baseball. And the baseball becomes so important for the people who are playing it. They advertise for teams to play them. Come on, we'll take on anybody kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, they had little classified ads in small town papers. And come on and play us, and things like that. But very enthusiastic. The community supported these baseball teams, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Point anyway, I want to emphasize is that this was an order of things. I should emphasize to you, too, that the people who were supervisors weren't allowed to play baseball.
I was wondering about that. I was wondering if they had some sort of insider.
They had to play cricket.
Ah.
And that otherwise, if you weren't on either of those teams, you had to be in the fire department for, say, Remington. And then you would help organize things on the field and get things set up right in the bleachers and things of that order. And then the women would then do, in essence, halftime performances to seventh inning or whatever. It wasn't seventh inning because these were usually seventh inning games. The idea was that there was a kind of community in which there was a kind of almost an ant hill organization or a beehive organization of things. All of this started with I knew that there was something there, but I had to build the images for it. And that was a very hard thing. I only found, by the way, one image of pre-1910 of a typewriter company baseball team on the field.
I guess they didn't find it important to the, it's you know, the stage photograph is what you would, you know, put on a 4x6 postcard to show people and send to people.
Easy.
The live shots, that didn't matter. That was, you know, it's kind of like factory people. The factory photographs you see a lot of times aren't people working there. Everybody's looking at the camera, not doing their work, mm-hmm. posing, that's right. because the cameras are still. You can't.
They're very
move.
Slow. Yeah. And the film's slow, and they have to have long exposures.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So I'm always, every time I do open the sort of the first, you're right, the first thing I do is open, flip through the photographs, and look to see what grabs me, which is kind of a bad way to say that, but you kind of you flip through.
I was curious because, like I said, Everett was driving on the way up here, and I, as we were parked a little mm-hmm. bit before coming over. It's got how many? What number issue is that on there on the front cover? 140.
Yeah, 134.
134. What's the history? I mean, you know, we talk about how did Austin Typewriter Inc. get started while we were having breakfast. What got this magazine going back in issue number one?
the 1980s, and it's also possible it was earlier than that because I don't know, have much information before the 1980s on this. There were newsletters. There were newsletters in England. There were newsletters in Europe. So two of which are quite important still right now. And there's a newer one there, CompU that Flavio does. Mm-hmm. But beyond the newsletters there were newsletters here. One of the people who did newsletters was a guy named Dickerson, who was a physicist in California, and this was before there were. This was before the internet. It was before people had very much access to historical resources, and he was trying to figure out, for example, the history of the production of Scholz and Glidden, and so he published his own little newsletter. And there was the newsletter that was published in Philadelphia that Mike Brown became mm-hmm. the editor of for a long time, and it was a very nice newsletter. It had interesting things, and they did some surveys that people would send in information about their typewriter with a serial number. So those newsletters existed. In about 1987, 88, I don't have the exact mm-hmm. date, somewhere in there, there was a typewriter meeting in California. And Darryl Rare was the sort of the center of that. And they formed the Early Typewriter Collectors Association. Now, at that time, we've got to realize that in 1988, even though computers were beginning to come into the system, offices had not gotten rid of all their typewriters at all. And mm-hmm. people still had, yes, and people still had a lot of portables in their homes and all. And at that time, the idea of early was really about the 19th century and the very early 20th century. And, of course, many of the typewriters we all love now, such as Corona 3s and Corona 4s and typewriters like the Remington Noiseless Portables and all, those are really, they're almost 100 years old now. We're talking mm-hmm. about they're early, too, in a sense. Right. The name is still a problem, is what I'm trying to get at.
Right.
It really needs to be to reflect more about just typewriters, because typewriters they're all early in that sense.
Right.
But at any rate, they decided to form this association, and they needed a newsletter, and it happened that Darryl Rare was an author and writer and a news person. So he decided he would be editor, and they agreed, and everybody decided there would be some dues, and he would produce a newsletter. And the original newsletter was a mimeograph kind of small newsletter. Exactly, and it's the way you made things, right?
Absolutely.
Right?
That's the technology.
And Darryl was a really enthusiastic collector, and he could put together quite a nice collection. And he collected also ribbon tins. He was probably the first person that I know of that had put flannel panels on the wall to stick the, mm-hmm. the ribbon tins on and all that. He tried to expand the hobby, as it were, or the mm-hmm. avocation that people had. And this was not a time when people thought of portables as something that was an unusual thing. Some people had been using them all along, certainly at home. And many people didn't have personal computers at home, but they might have had an office machine at the at the office. But at any rate, by the time he finished with it, he had shrunk the size of it, the outer dimensions, and had begun to produce some color with color Xeroxing. It was a big thing.
And then, Heck yeah, definitely color at that time. Everything was black and white or blue with the mimeograph, right?
And then I think he ends his production of it in 2006 or so. I think that's right. At any rate, earlier, and someone else had it. And then at any rate, Richard took it over in 2006, and he wrote me and asked me if I would like to do a column on ephemera. Mm-hmm. And a column, as you probably know, usually means one page or half of a page or whatever. But because of the images, there's no way it was going to stay one page. And Richard had many ideas about what the magazine could be. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there was a tremendous increase in the number of people taking it, partly because the interest in typewriters was exploding. Mm-hmm. In Europe, there already was a large group, but it was getting bigger. And in the United States and Canada, it was expanding. And with the internet, it also was possible to know about collectors in other places, such as in the Philippines or mm-hmm. in Hong Kong or in Malaysia or something of that order, a place of that order, or India. So people were communicating much more about typewriters. And of course, for example, in my case, in 2001, when I discovered the Maskelyne. Maskelyne is one of the most amazing typewriters ever made, created by a magician who made very complex magician machines, tricks, and he had his own magical museum in London and all. And he made this incredible typewriter that did proportional spacing and all sorts of things like that. And I was dreaming that since now we had collectors in India, we would find out that some of them had Maskelynes because of the British colonial system must have sent Maskelynes out there. And I was really excited. We were going to hear more about them and all, but it didn't happen, by the way.
Oh, no.
The Maskelynes fascinated me so much, I ultimately wrote an article about them in FAR, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what happened in that case was that things get started in funny ways. And I saw a picture of what looked like a kind of almost a noiseless portable on eBay. And I knew it wasn't a noiseless mm-hmm. portable, but it was just strange.
Yeah.
So it was not expensive. I probably paid $10 for it.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was their attempt to make a portable. And it was based on the Maskelyne. That's what the type bar set looked like, the Maskelyne type bar set. And so then I began to find out where the Maskelynes were. And I found out that even people who had them didn't really, they thought they had something, another model that they didn't have. The preferred model.
Everybody thought they had a prototype
something called
of some
the Victoria
sort.
Because of the celebration of Victoria's reign, the 50th anniversary or something. So one thing led to another. And the next thing I knew, I was working with the people at the London Technology Museum, and they had a real Victoria and could show the difference between the Victoria and what most people, those few people who had Maskelynes had. And I was able to talk about the history of the typewriter and then what happened to it and all. But it was fascinating. At any rate, because of his broad background, his wide range of interest in everything from philosophy to design, and a conception of the problems that were involved in the new digital age. Mm-hmm. He was an extremely good editor. He was a very generous editor, and as I got more vociferous, he would allow me more space.
we'll give you another half column over here.
And I read one of the I think it was the issue before this, Richard Polt has Martin Heidegger's, speaking of philosophers, and he has Martin Heidegger's typewriter, and Martin Heidegger scratched his name in the back of it, which I just that blew me away. I was like, oh, no way, that is so amazing.
Dumbfounding. Right? And, you know, when he was getting ready to write his book, The Typewriter Revolution, he would travel in Europe as well as in the United States, and he would meet with people, and they were talking about it as a revolution. So they would write postcards to each other in secret code. They would pretend it was secret code and all. It was really funny. But I think his book reflects a lot of his interest in the history of typewriters as well as the effect on the way people thought about things. And it was in the middle of that, he also taught a course, I think, in the middle of this on what reading and writing did to the way we think about things. And this is related to the larger issue of what we do with our typewriters and all. I think that the magazine flourished under Richard, and the quality improved in terms of the physical quality, the quality of the paper, the printing, the fact that we could use good color images that had solid colors in them rather than the kind of faded look that you get with Xerox, you know.
Right.
And the two biggest costs with this are the printing and then the mailing, the shipping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the authors for this, they do it on a voluntary basis, and it makes it possible to have a very interesting magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who are write for this write about something they're kind of passionate about. They like they like what they're writing about, and they're excited. And I think they bring that excitement to the readers.
For sure.
And typewriter history is wonderfully, as I mentioned before, the last time y'all were here, typewriter history is full of myths about typewriters that are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And the myths are fun, but they aren't history.
They are myths.
They're myths. And they are, but they are fun.
Mm-hmm.
And they often have little kernels of truth, but not a lot of mm-hmm. it. And so the magazine, et cetera, and the ones in Europe too, they provide the opportunity to kind of really solve some of these problems. The duplex issue is an example that everybody was sure that, for example, that the Dennis duplex had never been produced, but it was produced.
Mm-hmm.
And I with the help of Greg Fudosh, I was able to find an ad that showed that it was advertised. And the magazines, I had two magazines that said it was produced, but I wanted to see if they'd actually marketed it, and they had marketed it.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever found any surviving Dennis duplexes. They have duplexes, but not Dennis duplexes in the earliest.
Greg's still looking.
Everybody's still looking.
There's one in a barn in Wyoming somewhere.
Listen, they do turn up. Things turn up at barns. I became an expert on removing dove shit from the typewriters. No, they turn up at bars. They turn up in people's attics. They turn up in closets where they've been hidden until somebody's cleaning out a house or something of that order. I once got a little teeny, very small version of the simplex that you would print on boxes with it. It had no wood underneath the metal, and it was it had been found by someone who moved into an old farmhouse in Georgia, and they found it when they were cleaning out the attic, and then sold it on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the person's name who had owned it, and a little piece of paper of something they printed on it, and I sold that before I came here.
Uh-huh.
But it was really fun because these typewriters were owned by real people who did real things mm-hmm. with them.
They scratched their names on them. That is mine.
Put their names on them. That's exactly. Right. They identified with them. So anyway, that's how it became about. I guess between my et cetera columns and then little small pieces that I've also done for it, I've done around 66 things for et cetera since 2006.
It's fun. It's amazing because it brings some of these pieces forward. Like, you know, we hear myths of things that are myths until you. Now this is no longer a myth. This is hardcore information with photographs and period collections of. So it kind of demystifies some of the stuff and brings it forward, which is really nice because I know every once in a while we'll see somebody post something like Greg. I think recently Greg Fudosh just recently. I think it was a Royal Grand. And I was just like, no way. That's the best photograph I've ever seen of one. People discuss whether they even existed. And, of course, they do.
Well, the interesting thing about the Grand, the Grand was made on virtually the same time as the Standard, the flatbeds.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem, the story was, and it's an accurate story, that they wanted to have their ribbon spools parallel to the width of the thing, just like on a Remington 10 and a Remington 6, et cetera. And Remington claimed they owned the idea. So when they'd already used the spools on top of the platform on the the upper area. They'd already used that on the Standard, and then when they came out with the Remington, with the Royal 10, they basically a 10 is a grand with the spools on top. But the grand was so important to them, they used it as their logo, even when they were marketing the flatbed. So the truth of that story tends to be used by people who have myths to legitimate them, even though they're not backed by fact.
Right. No, it's fascinating because it's like, I think this brings the et cetera and your articles and your combination of photographs and image and text. Just it's always fascinating. Some of these, I actually had to read this one twice because it was, I had to go back through it twice because there's a lot of information. I'm like, I think I missed something on this. I had to go back and read it again.
Well, we were talking on the way to Houston about this particular machine that it kind of brings into the previous podcast that we talked about, the metallurgy. I always have a problem with that word. Talk a little bit about what we talked about.
Yeah, we were talking on the way here. We were talking. I was like, the article, I didn't get the article till after I got this, the magazine, after we had the first conversation. And I was after talking about metallurgy and everything, I was like, okay, that now it makes perfect sense. I understand exactly what he's talking about because this article is that, you know, the all of the reasons a machine or can succeed or fail are multiple, right? There's many reasons, bad financing, bad, you know, whatever that, there's so many reasons. And so it became painfully clear, you know, after reading this that there's the metal that was used in the machine wasn't up to par with what it should be. And so did you want to talk about that a little bit again?
Let's go back to Remington for a minute. Uh-huh. Remington had been mass producing and learning more about mass production, relatively speaking, relative mass production, during the Civil War with guns.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And they had, there were some problems of fatigue in metals that they'd had experience with, including springs and other things. And then they made sewing machines, right? And sewing machines have a lot of movement in them, even though the movement doesn't involve that many pieces, they're significant. And so when they came along in 1872 and 73, when they approached Remington to make to manufacture the Scholz and Glidden, they're in a position to have lots of production design engineering experience. They have metallurgy experience, and they know how to divide production jobs up. Now, within the limits of that period, they changed dramatically by the 1890s, but it became a true mass production system. But at any rate, initially they were kind of pooled together on tables, and they looked like kind of like picnic tables
right.
to make these things. At any rate, they had experience. When this company and many other companies wanted to do this, they wanted to make typewriters, they had to draw on what they could attract. There's another article in here on the Rapid, right? And the Rapid was originally made in Ohio. And in both cases, they had to find people who could do this work and could help them do the production design, et cetera, right down the line. These smaller companies start out in things that look like large garages, basically. And they often, by the way, burn down. That's another one of their problems, as well as you wonder if there's an insurance issue involved or other things like that.
A lot of burning.
things of that order. In the case of the duplex, originally the Dennis duplex, to get a supervisor for the factory, and supervisors were often also production design people, and then in some employees, they went to Elgin, Illinois, to a clock factory. And the clock people came to make the typewriter. Clocks don't have the same kind of problems about movement, that a tiny light stuff, not heavier stuff. Mm-hmm. And although they built a second factory in Des Moines, they never did solve the problem of production quality. And I think it was because they were drawing on people who simply just didn't have that background. On the East Coast, on the other hand, as you got other factories, the factories for Underwood and for originally Wagner's factory in New Jersey and Underwood in New Jersey, and then Royal in New York City, you had people who had metallurgical background, mm-hmm. had experience with it, many of whom, again, had come from Europe, who had been trained with a lot of small parts and big parts going together, et cetera. And I think that's what hurt a lot of these companies like this. So the metallurgy is extremely important, and they continue to develop some. In the case of Blickenserfer, what's interesting is, for whatever reason, Blickenserfer, George Blickenserfer, was particularly interested in aluminum. And aluminum, until, 1887 or so, had been made through a chemical process that was very expensive, and it was the most expensive metal in industrial systems. And that's why they put a little cube on top of the Washington Monument of aluminum. Because it was like the metal. You know. At any rate, around 1887, they began to use electricity to refine bauxite. And he was interested in casting aluminum. How early he begins is not too clear with the early models in 1890, 91, 92, when he's doing a lot of experimentation. But not long after they settle on the five as a production thing, they seem to begin to experiment with this, and I think this first sandcast aluminum body is probably somewhere around 1897 or so. They don't start producing aluminum machines, I don't think, until around 1906 or so. They may have used some aluminum parts in some of the machines, particularly the electric. I don't know. I've not looked inside of an electric, but they realize that portability is strongly based upon light, being weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the standard and folding
even 2 pounds or a pound and a half can make a big difference in how truly portable something is. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that while he's fiddling around with all this, in 1904, the Rose Typewriter Company in New York City is fiddling around with it in a very small one floor of a tall building for New York at the time, place with aluminum sheets. And that's where they made the first standard folding typewriters in New York. And they come out in 1907. And then by 1909, they're moving up to upstate New York. And there's a few changes. And then they figure out that there's a problem about the shifts being on two different sides, the shift for caps and figures, and they put them on the same side on the left. That's what becomes the basis of the Corona 3, and one of the bases for the Corona 3. But it's the standard folding 2 is what it is. At any rate, this almost everybody claimed portability as early as there's at least a couple of Remington ads for even things like the 4 and the 2 that claimed that they were portable. Then they claim they made a portable, but nobody can find it. It was a story about it in one of the New York newspapers, and that they had made a portable, a smaller version, and it was more easily carried about, et cetera, et cetera. But everybody claimed portability, you know, the Doherty Visible and all. Most people call it a Doherty Visible. I called it a Doherty Visible until one of his descendants told me that his name was Doherty. That's where the dock came from.
Gotcha.
Anyway, the metallurgy issue was important for all of them. I think that the use of aluminum was a great advantage, except it didn't work too well for key levers. Right. In the standard folding machines, the key levers tend to be too soft. If you push down hard, it'll bend them.
And just a little bit of a bend is your whole...
That's right. It messes up everything.
All gone.
Right now, we talk a lot, as you're talking about metallurgy and Civil War last time and how all that developed. Talk a bit about how typewriters in the 1890s, early 1900s, how did that change society when people were so used to writing with pen and paper? Am I going the right direction here? How did that change society when all of a sudden there were these machines that first appeared on the scene? And not only in this country, but basically in the world.
Well, before I say anything, I people might be interested in a book by Frederick Kittler that talks a lot about this issue in every way and how it's related to other technologies. And this other book that I just found that's by Gittleman, and it's called Scripts, Grooves, and Writing Machines. And these two books both try to speak to this these issues. Neither is really well illustrated. I should tell you mm-hmm. It's kind of frustrating. If we take a date, let's start with, say, 1870. In 1870, people regarded written communication as sort of the gold standard. And the difference between written communication that was done in beautiful handscript and as opposed to bad printing was seen as a difference in social status, a difference in intellect, a difference in the value of the words themselves. So even if you said dear, like dear John or whatever, if it looked ugly, then it didn't have any meaning. If it was written in a beautiful script, it meant that somebody really regarded you dear John.
Mm-hmm. So there was actually love put into there's a craft.
So there's a meta message, right? About the absolutely. Way that the letters are coded. By the 1880s, when you begin to when we move away from the kind of unusual aspects of having typewritten letters, certainly by 1882 to 1885 or so, you're beginning to have a lot of communication typewritten. When typewritten communications involved any kind of personal communication, they were regarded as offensive still. That if you wrote a letter even about a matter that might have some personal dimension to it, you're my brother-in-law, we're investing in land together and talking about the land deal, and by the way, how is my sister or something like that, it was regarded as just déclassé. You just couldn't do that.
Bad taste.
And it was bad taste. And you might even have the letter sent back to you with a nasty note saying, if you want to talk to me about this, write me.
Wow, that's a perspective.
It's like a phone call versus a text message.
Exactly. You got it. Exactly. It's exactly the issue. And even as late as 1900, there are stories that appear in papers about breaking off of engagements because a man wrote a love letter to a woman on a typewriter.
Wow.
And she sent it back and said, I never want to see you again. This is the kind of person you are. So there's that much of a weight or a valence placed on mm-hmm. on handwriting and script.
So like, some families were never formed simply because of the typewriter.
Perfect. So that's one dimension. The second thing is that this book by Gittleman, Scripts, Grooves, and Writing Machines, brings up an issue that is first raised, but in a little different way by Kittler, and that is that the more you automate a process in an office, and we're not talking about in factories, the more likely it would be a job that would be assigned to people as an unskilled job, even though we both know that high skill was required of typists, in not just in terms of their physical skills, but their intellectual skills. But it was regarded, the more automated it was in the office, the less likely it was going to be a man's job. The less automated it was, and the more decisions about market or ideas or whatever, the more it would be a man's job. And so even though you had entry-level jobs in offices, say, as male clerks who showed that they could clerk well, then would move up to one of these higher-level positions, supervisor in an office and then above. But the people who are going to get hired for the expanding mechanized, what they call the automated office, and the word automatic is discussed a lot in this book mm-hmm. and in the context of the 19th century, what it meant. The more automated it was, the less intellectual it was considered to be, and therefore more like the human being who was a piece of a connection in machines.
Absolutely.
And this devalues the people who do the work, right? Then that's a second category. So men did type, but men tried not to have to type in an office. They wanted to type in, for example, the context of telegraphy, of railroads, or as court reporters, all of which paid much more than the work that was done in offices using typewriters. Women, their challenge was this. They needed people, while claiming it was unskilled, they needed people who could spell. Which meant you had to have a fair amount of education. You had to go beyond, say, the third grade to be able to read, in the most basic sense, the Bible. You had to have a fairly large vocabulary and understand why meanings would change if you put words in different positions. the subtleties of that, as well as the formal issues about certain kinds of form letters that you had to send to a supplier versus an investor or something of that order. So initially, these are going to be middle-class women in urban areas, mainly in urban areas, who would then move into the office with skills like that, not treated terribly well and regarded by the growing middle class as not obeying proper standards for women because they were working in a men's environment and there was no protector there. And the way they tried to address this was a model they had from the textile factories in the Northeast and to some degree in the Southeast, but mainly in the Northeast, where the father would make the contract for her labor and make the deal with the owner and the supervisor in the factory so that she would be, quote, protected, so that people were not going to prey upon her, et cetera. That didn't last very long, but that, especially as they, in the, as you know, in these textile factories, they also had girls and boys, both as children working in these factories, with large numbers of people dying. They were very dangerous places to work.
So did the use of the typewriter, though, because like you said before, it was handwritten, because the typewriter at a point started to become standard in offices, and you needed people, as you say, educated enough to be able to utilize them efficiently. What happened? What happened in our culture?
In the middle of the one of the things that happens is that because of the danger in factories, and the textile factories were a good example of this, women who worked in factories were regarded as often very not only unprotected, but also easily killed. So the idea was an office job was a safe job, comparatively.
There you go.
So look at this generous, wonderful thing we're doing for women by employing them more in the office. And it between 1880 and 1895, there is a tremendous increase in demand for men to be typists, and they're not getting the jobs filled. So all the magazines and their whole publishing industry gets involved in this that has to do with stenography and typing. Why is it men are not going to the office to be typists? And because they don't want to be identified with this kind of lower level automatic kind of job in which there's no brain involved. It's that idea. And the second problem, from 1876 on, 75 on, Remington realizes that they can't sell typewriters if people can't use them. Mm-hmm. So you start out with schools in Ilion and other places, and then quickly more way beyond Ilion, that are going to teach people not only how to type. They already have stenography schools, but they're going to add typing to it, and they're going to add learning vocabulary and spelling. So these may have been people who started out with a third grade education, but they are going to leave with what we would consider maybe a middle school or junior high education. And they're going to at least have that background to do this. It was regarded as a further justification for why the women couldn't stay in the office after they married, because their skills were interchangeable with all these other young women who could be paid so little. Again, we're talking about wages that were usually a third of starting salaries for men, which also devalued the work further. But it was the actual fact that they were machine producers also decreased their value of these women and increased the value of the men who did other things and then went beyond that level to in the company. The other thing is that originally the portables, right, were intended to appeal to men originally. And you see this in Hammond ads and in some other portable ads by 1915. They're trying to attract people, men, into buying portables to be able to work at home. I don't think it worked very well. They show pictures of them, but the people who used it at home were more likely to be women, often who had had some typing training before, now were at home, and they were going to then be able to play a role in society using their typewriters, in a sense. But that communication was a different thing. They'd create newsletters for the local women's club or something of that order using these. And all this is paralleling other technology, right? A.B. Dick's mimeograph and such things as that, originally etigraph or Edison mimeograph. It wasn't until there's an explosion after World War I in the concept that most people should go to high school, and women included, and they should finish high school. Now, most high school, I think at that time, was 3 years. It wasn't four. There were exceptions, private schools in particular, but most of them were three-year programs. And the idea was is that you would take typing in that, and then you would go on into life, or you would go to college. Well, the portables, just they made a much easier way to handle the problem. The companies didn't know what to do about portables, because just as they had originally seen used typewriters as competitors with new typewriters, right, and they worried them, until they owned the used typewriter thing of rebuilding typewriters. Mm-hmm. So that's what, for example, Calligraph, American Writing Machine, became the rebuilder for Remington under the Union Trust and all. Until then, they were really worried about competition from all machines. The typewriter companies had very mixed feelings about having portables at all, because they were afraid that people would buy them instead of paying the big bucks
standards,
for them.
Yeah.
And this is at a time when there were a lot of rebuilds and new office machines. So they had different approaches to the problem. I think when you were a portable-only company like Corona, you wanted to make the best machine you could. When you were a major company like L.C. Smith Brothers Company that made the L.C. Smith 1, 2, and the big seller 10, you weren't so sure what to do. Finally, what you decided to do is not design your own, you just buy the company, and they bought Corona.
Right. Just buy the competition.
And Remington, though, really had everything invested in big machines. So, you know, they made the Remington Junior, and then they made the under another brand, the Century, in the old Smith-Mirre factory in Syracuse, but they never had their heart in it. They never pushed it very hard. Not very many of them were sold. They weren't a bad machine. They were kind of interesting little machines. But they sort of saw it as kind of deciding whether or not, well, we'll see whether we're going to produce a portable or not. And meanwhile, Underwood got ahead of them. And Underwood made the little three-bank and quickly planned, I think early on, that they had to go to a four-bank because that was the dominant form of keyboard. They even built a separate factory to make the later three banks and then the four banks in Bridgeport, Connecticut, away from their main factory in Hartford. Certainly by the 1930s, you have this kind of thing about Royal, I think, really wanted to make a good portable. Mm-hmm. They saw them as a way of matching and paralleling their sales of their regular typewriters, not for office use. They were too small for office use, too light. But they could be used well at home with the same keyboard, many of the same characteristics of the large machine. As time goes by, though, it's pretty clear that a lot of the typewriter companies that were made office machines, they didn't want to put a lot of eggs into the portable basket. And they made machines that weren't very good.
Mm-hmm.
We see this most closer to us in time. By the 1960s, even Olympia, even though many of us love the SM 3, 4, 7, whatever, they regarded those as three-year machines. These were considered to be kind of a way to satisfy customers who were big clients, but not a way to have a good machine that would last a long time. Well, we know that wasn't true, probably because they had trouble designing a crappy machine.
Right, they can't make a bad machine.
But they were not intended to be lasting machines. And salespeople did not see a much smaller cut when they sold, wholesale even, the Olympia portables than they got when they sold an office machine or a set of office machines. So their heart wasn't in it either. So it's amazing that we have these great machines, so many of them around. But anyway, that's kind of a quick way to answer your question.
Yeah. No, that's there's so many things going through my head. It's like I've got so many little bits and pieces, but that's fascinating. We know that the portables were not, they're not built for office use, but there was such a demand for them that they were asking for them. I know Royal held off for a long time because they were behind on Corona and Underwood, and they were kind of holding back. And finally, they came out with a machine that kind of resembled the other one. It was kind of like a baby to it.
They did drag their feet, and Royal was being by that time was becoming quite successful.
Mm-hmm.
with the 10, and and it was getting to be a better and better machine, and a lot of people were glad not to be involved with Remington because mm-hmm. Remington had a significant number of problems, and Remington was had a large base for a repair, but it was a loosey-goosey machine.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice that the Remington 10 didn't even have a sector until 1923, mm-hmm. thereabouts, 22, somewhere in there. And they had to pay Underwood a royalty for that sector.
Wow. What was happening in, I guess, American society, maybe world, that was pulling and influencing typewriters so much in their design and usage during that period that's so prevalent?
First and foremost, there was this tremendous expansion even before World War I of the use of typewriters. They've become the way to reproduce writing, to transcribe records of a variety of things. They parallel in many offices the development of the dictaphone, which is also a record-keeping mm-hmm. thing, and they were linked by the typist between the dictaphone here and the mm-hmm. typing here in terms of transcription. There was a lot of competition. Underwood was just plain and simply a better machine than any of the Remingtons were. It was better made. It had better alignment. It did not require near as much maintenance, and it was easier to rebuild in some ways too. It was planned to be a kind of modular, to some degree, a modular thing. I think World War I comes along. One, it first affects Europe, obviously, and especially in terms of not being bombed for the most part, England, and there's a shortage of typists. There's a shortage of machines for this purpose. But luckily, the war didn't last very long for the United States. It's 1718, right?
Mm-hmm.
After the war and this tremendous expansion that takes place, things are a little slow after World War I. The government quits having big contracts and all. So between about 1919 and 1922, things are a little bit of a recession. But suddenly things take off. It's a lot of speculative investment. There's much more urbanization. Businesses and services expand rapidly. And there's a tremendous demand for typewriters. So you have competition. Big time competition. So the typewriter companies want to update what they look like. A lot of it's resheeting, a little like what we did with cars,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Some of it involves small changes that do make a difference and take care of flaws of various kinds, etc. Meanwhile, there's a tremendous increase in the demand for the people to be typists. And so you have this big expansion of what were then called business schools, some of which became universities later. Get taken over by the state or remain private schools, but most large cities have at least one of these that started out as a quote business school. Most of that because we think business often involves marketing and design and other things. These mainly were places to teach people to type, to teach people how to manage an office, how to manage basic booking in accounting and such things as that. The only thing that hurt them was is that a lot of regular universities, started having their own business schools. The problem is to get your product to stand out. So there's a tremendous amount of advertising everywhere, including in women's magazines, to get them to buy portables, but also to influence them about buying office machines, because often they are also an influencer in the office about what machines are bought. And not just whether for their own machine, but the whole order for the machines. You know,
was there ever a myth in that advertising about machines that didn't, you know, sell itself or work? I don't know if I phrased that question right.
I know what you're.
I think on Peter's point that kind of brings to mind, a lot of times they were self promoting, and they like Remington and each of the people they had touch typing classes. You know, Remington would give you a pen if you could get 45 words a minute, 60 words a minute. You know,
so there was more than that. They actually ran employment services,
right?
Free employment services. And so if you needed someone for a day, you call the Remington dealer, or you call the Royal dealer, or you call the Underwood dealer, and they would find someone quickly for you, send them over. If you don't have the machine, they'd send them with a machine.
A typewriter with a typewriter.
And what's interesting is in these early magazines that run through the 1910s, there were debates about what to call these people. Should they be called typists? Should they be called typewriters? This kind of thing. And there was a recognition by 1892 or 93 that virtually everybody who used a typewriter was also a stenographer. Right. And stenographer had been a whole separate thing at one point, and now they're really mixed. To come back to the problem, they gave gifts to women in the offices to try to get them to be interested in their needs, etc. That's what these little premiums that they gave them, mirrors and other things. They were very imaginative. That continued right up until at least 1970,
wow,
giving rain hats and raincoats and other things that had their name on them, things of that order. Second thing is that they were really, they had started this much earlier, but they pushed much harder about the idea of let us place a machine in your office and you'll see the difference kind of thing.
It's a test ride.
So, and no cost to you, we'll place our machine in your office. We'll even provide you with these reams of paper. You know, that's whatever it might take, because this was big money. They had the idea by no later than 1900 that if you could play, well, it starts earlier really, but it's not in a big way. If they could get machines into these training schools as the machine, they thought that the person would become an Underwood person or a royal person or whatever it might be, and they would insist on them in their office. And as they began to, one of the things they figured out, it took them a long time, especially until after World War I, that if you had different levels of models, the equivalent of, be a model maybe called the president, as opposed to one that's called the
executive
messenger or something like that, that you would have the opportunity to have the executive secretary have the highest level, and it would pull everything else into the office. And they were, most of these machines had what we today call delete options. They were the same machines, but they would simply not put the extra thing in it. See, it was like scratching out a chip or something.
I see that a lot in the Depression era, once in the 38, right there. They had, they just, how much can we strip off of this and it still be functional?
They did it with the Remingtons and the Royals, et cetera. Yep. But what's different about the 30s is that they were having so much trouble selling anything. That's when you get this introduction to these kind of twix-and-tween portables that are very heavy portables. They're office portables. What is it? The Remington 8 Noiseless is a. It looks like an architectural piece. You probably have seen.
I've got two of them.
Well, you know,
David loves the Remington.
Well, that's an example of this kind of. That's a heavy machine.
It is,
And it continued after the war too. That Olivetti Studio 44 is an example of a kind of a semi-office machine. It's very heavy. Mm-hmm. Doesn't jump around at all.
It's solid.
It's not anything like that. At any rate, the problem was always getting people who could not only type, but also were really skilled at many other things, and you wouldn't have to pay them more.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, from the 1890s on, part of the purpose of these business schools and part of the purpose of typing and all typing classes, and then even some post-education, was for the secretary or the typist to be able to organize offices more efficiently. So one of the things that happens is Remington, by 1905, starts a quote house magazine called Remington Notes, which later is continued after Remington Rand buys them, called Rembrandt Notes. And these magazines were given away until the 1930s, mm-hmm. when they started charging. The idea was that they really were trying to get their salaries up, and the only position that paid more was executive secretary. And as you probably know from your own younger life experience, at any rate, the executive secretary really was an administrator,
mm-hmm.
but they never called her that. They didn't call them office coordinators and administrators until, 15 years ago or so. Generally speaking, they were simply called executive secretary, but they were really the manager of the office. They really ran everything, and they were the gatekeeper about everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you could get things straightened out with them, you could do anything.
Billing, hiring.
getting a yes from whoever the final decision maker was always through that person.
And right. That person controlled the boss. They were really the boss.
And she always had to have a special typewriter. It became more and more a part of this ordering of model levels.
It's a symbol of sorts.
And in many ways, the model ordering started with the portables because of the Depression. So you had, you know, when the P came out, there was just the P, the Royal P.
Yeah, that's no options. That's it.
and when the O comes out, it's basically the O. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then they kind of fudge a little bit and they say, all right, we'll have a Royal Junior. Remember, mm-hmm. which is the guts of the P, and the. So what I'm getting at is the 30s taught them about model ordering,
right?
Hierarchy, just as the car companies figured this out too. So after the war, you have this very strong emphasis on different levels of typewriter and with different features, et cetera, but they are basically the same machine to with these delete options on them. And, you know, if you got the basic one, you could only get a black one and it would not have this or that on it. A little line measuring thing on one end of the platen or something of that order. And then, of course, IBM was a kind of gray eminence in all this, because IBM takes a system that was developed for a different reason and bought by Remington and made an electric typewriter with 2728, right? Something like that. They didn't know how to market it, and partly because they had just assumed they had this big problem. They thought they were it. You know, that always is a problem in an organization that wants to survive. And they quit making it, and the whole thing got sold to this time clock company, International Business Machines, which did some other stuff, but not much. And they made the Electromatic. Okay, and the Electromatic was one big ugly machine. There's no way of saying it's a beautiful thing.
Beautiful engineering on the inside.
Even with the red keys. One of the things that was really interesting about the Electromatic is it had all these moving parts in it, and it had to have servicing regularly. Mm-hmm. And early on, IBM figures out that servicing is where they're going to make their money. Mm-hmm. And this is a bottle that served them all the way through the dominance of IBM. Is service is the game.
So sell 1,000 machines to that company, and then you service them.
Yep. So the electric typewriters, like the Electromatic, often were only in the executive office, or they were only available to special people, etc. Then World War II comes, and the Census Bureau, 1910, starts using punch cards, which are based, as you know, on Jacquard cards for programming weaving in France and other places. So the problem was, how do you connect everything together to make it a system? And so during World War II, they developed this thing about the cards being set up for punching with the Electromatic, right, with the same technology. And before the war is over, the Electromatics are being used to aim guns on ships and things of that order. That's why we find naval IBMs. Not a lot of them around, but they're around. Because in the signals room, they had the Underwoods. But in the gun, whatever it was called, the place where you aim the guns out of the bowels of the ship.
Fire.
It was the Electromatics. And then after the war, they're working on their computers. And, of course, Remington Rand is working on their computers, especially after they're bought by the gyroscope company, I think, Sperry Rand, becomes Sperry Rand. But they're still missing the boat. They're thinking in terms of gigantic computers, multiple room computers, etc. And I don't think they had a lot of choice in the initial period, but I think their devotion to it was not as great as it should have been. Mm-hmm. And the typewriters were still their thing, et cetera. And I'll give Smith, L.C. Smith Corona, some credit. They tried to move along with the new technology. Mm-hmm. So they began to make electrical typewriters, mm-hmm. using some digital technology, little teeny screens for correction and all. It's amazing how many of their late production electronic typewriters today are available that never were used. They're in the box.
Wow. And we see people that post that sometimes. They'll find it and go, this is a brand new, never used machine.
Still in the box.
So we've covered a lot of great information in this past hour, Peter. So I want to thank you for joining us today. Everett, you have any last quick thoughts on this?
No, I'm just blown away again. This is amazing. This is great information. I love hearing the stories and the weaving of the stuff you read, and then the story, then when you talk about it, it comes to life for me.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. We're going to have some more conversation with Peter.
Thank you. I really appreciate your coming.
Stay tuned, folks, because we've got more coming right here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Thank you for listening to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. For more information about our group, please find us online at austintypewriterinc.com, or you can also visit us on Facebook and Instagram. Join us next time for another episode of Austin Typewriter Inc. May your type slugs always be clean.